Chapter 28.
They weren't coming. From the start, I had known their chances were slim, but every time I looked at Rafe's face, I mustered new hope for his sake. These were not just soldiers coming to help free a wayward prince and princess. These were his friends. Hope is a slippery fish, impossible to hold on to for long. My Aunt Cloris would say when I pined for something she deemed childish and impossible. Then you have to hold harder, my Aunt Burnett would counter to her older sister before ushering me away in a huff. But some things slipped from your grasp no matter how hard you held on to them. We were on our own. Rafe's friends were dead. It wasn't a whisper in my ear or a prickle at my neck that told me. It was the rules of reason that prevailed, the rules of everything I could understand and see. They said it plainly. This was a harsh land with no forgiveness for enemies. I watched Rafe each night, stealing a glance when I was sure no one was looking. While my movements within the sanctum were still closely guarded, his had grown freer, and both Calantha and Ulrich's had become less watchful. With calculating patience, he was cultivating their trust. Ulrich's, while still a frightening beast of a man, seemed to have given up with his fist, and Rafe suffered no more split lips, almost as if he had judged Rafe an acceptable excuse of a man even though he was enemy swine. Ingratiating yourself with a beast like Ulrich's was truly a work of skill. Rafe drank with the Chievdars, laughed with governors, spoke quietly with servants. Young maids brushed close, endeared by his stilted attempts at speaking Venden, eager to refill his mug, smiling at him beneath lowered lashes. But a new identity, no matter how well played, would do him little good once the Komazar discovered he was lying. It was as if, with the Komazar gone, everyone had forgotten Rafe's looming death sentence. Or maybe they just thought it would never come to pass. Rafe was convincing. Someone was always pulling him aside. Chievdars probing about the Dalbrek military, or governors curious about his powerful distant kingdom, for though they ruled their own small fiefdoms here, they had little or no knowledge of the world that lay beyond the great river. They only knew it by way of the rattan who spirited past borders, or by provisi wagons that shared its treasures. The treasures and their abundance, that was what intrigued them the most. The small, infrequent loads brought by the provisi weren't enough to satisfy their appetites, nor, apparently, was the booty of slaughtered patrols. They hungered for more. I wore my dress of leather scraps tonight. When I entered the hall, I noticed Calantha speaking to a maid, and the girl came running over. "It would please Calantha if you would braid your hair." She held up a small strip of leather to tie it with. I saw Calantha watching us. Every night now, she insisted I say the blessing. It seemed to please some, but heavily rankled others, especially the rattan, and I wondered if she was trying to get me killed. When I questioned her motives, she said, "It amuses me to hear you say the words in your odd drawl, and I need no greater reason. Remember, princess, you're still a prisoner." I had needed no reminder of that. "You can tell Calantha I have no intention of braiding my hair just to please her." I aimed a stiff smile at Calantha. When I looked back at the girl, her eyes were wide with fright. It was a message she wasn't keen to deliver. I took the strip of leather from her hand. "But I will do it for you." I pulled my hair over my shoulder and began braiding it. When I was finished, the girl smiled.
"Now your pretty picture will show," she said, "just as Calantha wanted."
Calantha wanted my cravat to show? The girl started to run away, but I stopped her. "Tell me, is Calantha of the Marasi clan?" The girl shook her head. "Oh, I'm not to tell, ma'am." She turned and ran away. Not to tell? I think she already had. The meal went as all the others before it had. I said the blessing to the humble bowed heads of a few and the scowls of many. The fact that it gnawed at Malik the most made it worth it to me, and I always made a point to slap my gaze on his before I began. But then the words took over, the bones, the truth, the pulse of the walls around me, the life that still dwelled in stones and floor, the part of the sanctum that was growing stronger in me. And by the time the last Paviyama echoed back, the scowls mattered not to me. Tonight the fare was much the same as every night. Thick barley gruel flavored with peppermint leaves, soda bread, turnips, onions, and roasted game, boar and hare. There was little variation, except with the game. Beaver, duck, and wild horse were sometimes served too, depending on what game was caught. But compared to my frequent diet of sand, squirrel, and snake across the Camlan Toe, it was a veritable feast, and I was grateful for every bite. I was just dipping my soda bread into the gruel when a sudden sharp clatter roared down one of the hallways that led into the sanctum. Every man was on his feet in an instant, swords and knives drawn. The ruckus grew louder. Rafe and I exchanged a furtive glance. Could this be his men? With reinforcements? 2 dozen men emerged, the Komazar leading them. He was filthy, spattered with mud from head to foot, but he appeared to relish the squalor. A rare, sloppy smile was plastered across his face. "Look who we ran into on the road," he said, waving his sword over his head. "The new governor of Balwood. More chairs. Food. We're hungry." The company of men swarmed to the table in all their glorified filth, leaving trails of mud behind them. I spotted the one who had to be the new governor, a young man, both brazen and afraid. His eyes darted around the room, quickly trying to assess new threats. His movements were sharp and his laughter tight. He may have just killed the last governor to gain this position, but the sanctum was not his homeland. New rules would have to be learned and navigated, and he'd have to manage to stay alive while he did it. His position was not so unlike mine, except I hadn't killed anyone to gain this dubious place of honor. And then the Komazar spotted me. He dropped his gear to the floor and crossed the room, stopping an arm's length away. His skin glowed with a day's ride in the sun, and his dark eyes gleamed as they traced the lines of my dress. He reached up and fingered the braid falling over my shoulder. "With your hair combed, you only look half the savage." The room erupted in loyal laughter, but his gaze that glided over me told a different story, one that wasn't humorous or amusing. "So, while the Komazar is away, the prisoners will play." He finally turned to Caden. "This is what my coin bought?" I prayed Caden would say yes so the blame would fall to us. Otherwise, Ephira's generous gifts might be repaid with retaliation. "Yes," Caden answered. The Komazar nodded, studying him. "I found one, Governor. Now it's your turn to find the other. You leave in the morning." "Why you?" I asked, jerking the tether loose at my waist. It clattered to the floor. Caden continued to rummage through his trunk, throwing out a long fur-lined cloak and woolen socks. "Why not me? I'm a soldier, Leah. I reached out and grabbed his arm, forcing him to look me in the eye. Worry filled his eyes. He didn't want to leave. "Why are you so loyal to him, Caden?" He tried to turn back to the trunk, but I gripped his arm tighter. "No," I said. "You're not evading me again. Not this time." He stared at me, his chest rising in controlled breaths.
He fed me when I was starving, for one thing.
A charitable act is no reason to sell your soul to someone.
Everything is so simple to you, isn't it?
Anger flashed across his face.
It's more complicated than an act, as you call it.
Then what? He gave you a nice cloak? A room in the...
His hand flew through the air.
I was traded, Leah. Just like you were.
He looked away as if he was trying to regain his composure. When he looked back at me, the hot fury was still in his eyes, but his tone was slow and cynical.
Except in my case, there were no contracts. After my mother died, I was sold to a passing ring of beggars for a single copper, as if I were a piece of trash, with only one caveat: to never bring me back.
You were sold by your father? I asked, trying to fathom how anyone could do such a thing. In seconds, sweat had sprung to his face. This was the memory that mattered, the one he had always refused to share.
I was 8 years old, he said. I begged my father to keep me. I fell to his feet and wrapped my arms around his legs. To this day, I have never forgotten the sickening scent of jasmine soap on his trousers.
He shut the trunk lid and sat down, his eyes unfocused as if reliving the memory.
He shook me off. He said it was better that way. The better was 2 years with accomplished beggars who starved me so I could bring in more money on street corners. If a day's begging didn't bring enough in, they beat me, but always where it didn't show. They were careful that way. If I still didn't bring in enough, they threatened to take me back to my father, who would drown me in a bucket of water like a stray cat.
His gaze turned sharp, cutting into me.
It was the Komazar who found me begging on a muddy street. He saw the blood seeping through my shirt after a particularly bad beating. He pulled me up on his horse and took me back to his camp, fed me, and asked who had whipped me. When I told him, he left for a few hours, promising it would never happen again. When he returned, he was sprayed with blood. I knew it was their blood. He was true to his word, and I was glad.
He stood and snatched his cloak from the floor. I shook my head, horrified. Caden, it's an abomination to whip a child, and just as bad to sell one. But isn't that all the more reason to leave Venda for good? To come to Morrigan and...
I was Morrigese, Leah. I was a bastard child born to a highborn lord. Now you know why I hate royals. That's who the Komazar saved me from.
I stared at him, unable to speak. No, it wasn't true. It couldn't be. He threw his cloak around his shoulders.
Now you know who the real barbarians are.
He turned and left, the door thundering shut behind him. And still I stood there. His schooling in the holy songs. His reading. His flawless Morrigese. True. The scars on his chest and back. True. But it wasn't Avendon who had done this to him, as I had always supposed. It was a high-born lord of Morrigan. Impossible. The candle burned out. The lanterns did too. I lay curled in the bed and stared into the dark, reliving every moment, from the time he walked into the tavern to our long trip across the Camlanteau. All the times I marveled at his tender ways that were such a glaring contrast to what he was, an assassin. All the times.
the way he was so comfortable in the Morrigies' world. It seemed perfectly obvious now. He was reading the games board. It was Venden he didn't know how to read, not Morrigies. Pauline and I had both noted how well he sang the holy songs, while Rafe knew none of the words. He had been raised until he was 8 as the son of a Morrigies lord. Caden's own kind, my kind, had betrayed him, except for his mother. She was a saint, he had said. What had happened to her? It must have been from her that he learned his tender ways. It might be she was the only one in his entire life who had shown him any love or compassion, until the Komazar came along. It was the middle of the night when he returned. The room was completely black, and yet he moved quietly through it as if he could see in the dark. I heard him set something down, a loud thunk, and then I heard the scant ruffling sounds of clothing being laid out and the soft sigh of his breaths as he lay down on the rug. The room was heavy with silence. Long minutes passed. I knew he wasn't asleep. I could feel his thoughts in the darkness, his stare drilling into the timbers above him. "Caden," I whispered, "tell me about your mother." Her name was Catherine. She was very young when she was hired on as governess by a lord and his wife, but soon they discovered she had the gift as well. The lady pressed her daily for thoughts on her own young sons, but soon the lord pressed her for other things. Caden was born and knew no other way of life. He thought it was normal to live in a cottage on his father's estate. When his mother became ill and her life was quickly withering away, she begged the lord to take Caden into the manor. The lady would have none of it. A bastard wouldn't be raised with her noble-bred sons, and even though the lord promised Catherine he would take Caden, it seemed he had agreed with his wife all along. His mother wasn't even cold yet when Caden was given to passing beggars without a backward glance. His mother was beautiful, crystal blue eyes, black hair that was soft and long. Gentle and slow to anger, she was a teacher above all. She tutored Caden right along with the lord's sons. At night in the cottage, they looked out the window at the stars, and she whispered the stories of the ages, and Caden repeated them back to her. He was too young to fully understand why the lord's sons received special privilege, but when he became angry about it, his mother would gather him in her arms and croon against his cheek that he was far richer in the things that mattered, because he had a mother who had more love for him than the whole universe could contain. But then suddenly, he didn't have her. He had nothing. One of his biggest regrets was that he bore his father's white blonde hair and brown eyes. When he looked in a mirror, he at least wanted to see some measure of his mother. "I see her, Caden," I said. "I see her in you every day. From the moment I met you, I saw your calmness, your tender ways. Pauline herself told me you had kind eyes. That's more important than their color." He remained silent except for a low, shaky breath. And then we both went to sleep.
Chapter 29.
He was up early, before the sun, before stirrings, before clops or neighs or the first birds of morning. It felt as though we had just gone to sleep. He lit a candle and stuffed his saddlebag. I stretched in my bed and stood, pulling the quilt over my shoulders. "I've left some supplies for you in the bag by the door," he said. "I raided the kitchen for what food I could so you can leave the room as little as possible. I arranged for Aster, Eben, and Grizz to come check on you each day. With luck, we'll meet the governor on the road and we'll be back by nightfall."
"And if you're not?"
His province is in the far south of Venda. It'll be a few weeks.
So much could happen in a few weeks, in a few days. But I didn't say it. I could see the same thought in his eyes. I only nodded, and he turned to leave.
I blurted out a question that burned in me when he reached the door. Which lord was it, Caden? Who did this to you?
His hand paused on the latch, and then he looked back over his shoulder.
Does it really matter which one? Doesn't every lord have his bastards?
Yes, it does matter. Not every lord is a depraved monster like your father. You can't stop believing in the good ones.
But I have, he said.
His voice was empty of emotion, and his resignation tore through me. He turned back to the door as if to leave, but stood there not moving.
Caden, I whispered.
He dropped his saddlebag and walked back to me, cupped my face in his hands, his eyes warm and hungry, and kissed me, his lips soft against mine, then harder, earnest, my mouth meeting his with tenderness. He slowly pulled away and looked into my eyes.
A real kiss, he said. That's what I needed. Just one more time.
He turned away, grabbed his saddlebag, and left. And twice in the space of just a few hours, I was breathless as he left the room. I closed my eyes, hating myself. I found no satisfaction in the fact that I had become as accomplished at deception as Caden. All I tasted on my lips was my carefully calculated lie.
Chapter 30.
The door shook with pounding from the other side. I knew it wasn't Aster or Eben, not even Malik. Caden had said Malik would be occupied with duties all day. It was at night that I had to be watchful. Another impatient knock. I hadn't properly dressed yet or combed my hair. What fool didn't know I was locked in and a key was required to open the door? Grizz? I finally heard the rattle of a key in the lock, and the door opened. It was the Komazar.
Most doors in the sanctum aren't locked. I'm not in the habit of calling someone for a key.
He walked in past me.
Get dressed, he ordered. Do you have anything proper for riding? Or did the Marassi only clothe you with their dress of rags?
I hadn't moved, and he turned around to look at me.
Your mouth is open, princess.
Yes, I said, my mind still reeling. I do, over there. I walked to the chest where they were folded on top and grabbed them from the pile. I have riding clothes.
Then put them on.
I stared at him. Did he expect me to dress in front of him? He smirked.
Ah, modesty. You royals.
He shook his head and turned around.
Hurry up about it.
His back was to me, and Natia's knife was within reach under my mattress. Not yet, a voice so deep and buried I tried to pretend it wasn't there. It was the perfect time. His guard was down. He didn't know I had a weapon. Not yet. Was this the gift, or was I just afraid of incurring a target on my own back? I would be a target, an easy one. A 3-inch knife might make short work of an exposed jugular, but it couldn't take on a whole army, and what good would I do Rafe if I was dead? But then thoughts of Walther and Greta pushed aside reason. Do it. My fingers trembled. No mistakes this time, Leah. Revenge and escape battled within me.
Well?
He asked impatiently. Not yet. A whisper as strong as an iron door slamming shut.
I'm hurrying.
I threw off my nightshirt and put on fresh underclothes, praying he wouldn't turn around. Being seen naked should have been the least of my worries right then, and I had never been particularly modest. But I raced gazelle swift to get them and my riding clothes on, fearful his patience would run out, and mildly surprised he was showing any restraint at all.
There, I said, tucking my shirt into my trousers.
He turned and watched as I slipped on my belt, the tether of bones that had lengthened considerably, and finally the long, warm vest of many furs, again the revered symbol of the Marasi. He had bathed since last night. The mud of the road was gone, and the short, sculpted beard once again meticulously groomed. He stepped closer.
Your hair, he said. Comb it. Do something with it. Don't shame the vest you wear.
I surmised he wasn't taking me out to behead me if he cared about how my hair looked, but it seemed odd that he was even concerned how I looked at all. No, not odd. Suspicious. It wasn't about shaming the vest. He sat back in Caden's chair and watched every move as I brushed and braided it. Studying me. Not in the lecherous way Malik had ogled me countless times, but in a cool, calculated way that made me guard my movements even more. He wanted something and was devising how to get it. I tied off my braid, and he stood, grabbing my cloak from a hook.
You'll need this, he said,
and he put it around my shoulders, taking his time as he fastened it at my neck. I bristled when his knuckle grazed my jaw.
What did I do to deserve all these kind attentions? I asked.
Jezalia, he said, shaking his head. Always so suspicious.
He lifted my chin so I had to look in his eyes.
Come, let me show you Venda.
I was astonished that it felt good to be on a horse again. Even though we moved slowly through winding streets, every sway on the back of the horse held the promise of open spaces, meadows, and freedom. That is, if I ignored who rode next to me. He kept his horse close to mine, and I could feel his watchful eye, not just on me, but on everyone we passed. Their inquisitive stares were plain. They had heard of the princess prisoner of Morrigan.
Push back your cloak a bit. Let them view your vest.
I looked at him uncertainly, but did as he asked. He had seemed angry with Caden about how his coin was spent, but now he seemed absorbed by it. I was being paraded, though I was uncertain why. Only a little over a week ago, he had marched me through the sanctum in front of his council, barefoot and half-naked in a burlap sack that could barely be called a dress. That, I understood, demean the royal and take her power away. Now it was as though he was giving it back, but I felt in the deepest part of my gut that the Komazar never gave up even the smallest fistful of power. You have been welcomed by the clan of Murasi. Was a welcome something even the Komazar didn't know how to navigate? Or maybe it was simply his intent to control it. We meandered through the Bright Mist Quarter, which was at the northernmost part of the city. He seemed to be in particularly good spirits as we rode through the streets, calling out to shopkeepers, soldiers, or a paddy clapper scooping up horse manure to be padded into fuel, because, as I had learned, even wood was not easy to come by in Venda, and dried horse dung burned warmly. He told me we were headed to a small hamlet about an hour away, but he didn't tell me for what purpose. He was an imposing figure in the saddle, his dark hair ruffling in the breeze, his black riding leathers gleaming under a hazy sky. He had saved Caden. I tried to imagine the person he had been, almost a boy himself when he had lifted a child to his horse and whisked him away to safety. Then he went back to butcher Caden's tormentors.
Do you have a name? I asked.
A name?
One that you were born with, given by your parents, besides Komazar, I clarified, though I thought my question was obvious. Apparently it wasn't.
He thought for a moment and answered stiffly,
No, only Komazar.
We passed through an unguarded gate at the end of the lane. Sparse brown meadowlands spread out before us, and we left the crowded, smoky, mud-soaked avenues of the city behind us.
We'll have to ride faster, he said. I'm told you ride well, but maybe that's only when bison are bearing down on you?
No doubt Grizz and Finch had shared their narrow escape, and mine.
I manage, I said.
For a royal.
Though his horse was new to me, I dug in my heels and raced ahead, praying it would respond to my commands. I heard the Komazar galloping close behind me, and I pushed my horse faster. The air was icy crisp, stinging my cheeks, and I was grateful for the fur vest beneath my cloak. He met my pace and pulled slightly in front of me. I snapped my reins, and we ran head to head. I felt my horse still had vast stores of untapped power, and it was as eager as I was to show it, but I slowed just a bit, so the Komazar would think he had bested me, and then when he surged ahead, I returned to a trot. He circled back around, laughing, his face flushed with the cold, his dark-lashed eyes dancing at our small game. He took his place beside me, and we continued on at a trot with the soldiers keeping pace a short distance behind us. We passed the occasional hovel, the grass so sparse, the way so little traveled, there was hardly a path at all. The small stone houses had scrabbled gardens and swoop-backed horses with not enough meat on their ribs to garner a second glance from a wolf. The landscape was harsh, stark. It was a wonder that anyone was able to scratch out a life here. But there were occasional fingers of forest and slivers of earth that were fertile and green, and as we breached a rise, I spotted the hamlet that was our destination. A nest of thatch-roofed huts huddled into a hillside, and a stand of pines hovered over them. A longhouse stood apart from the huts, and smoke rose in lazy circles from its chimney.
Saint-Chevel, the Komazar said. The hill folk in hamlets like these are the poorest but toughest of our breed. The sanctum may be the heart, but this is the backbone of Venda. Word spreads quickly among the hill folk. They are our eyes and ears.
I stared at the small cluster of huts. It was the kind of hamlet I could have passed 100 times in Morrigan and ignored. But looking at it now, something beat within me, a bewildering but urgent need. My horse pranced nervously out of step, as if he felt it too. The breeze swirled around my neck, heavy and cold, and I saw a hole widening, deepening, swallowing me up.
I knew you would come.
I was struck with the same fear and frenzy as on the day I passed the graveyard with Pauline. My fingers tightened on the reins.
We're all part of a greater story, too, one that transcends the soil, the wind, time.
I didn't want to be part of this story. I wanted to run back to Terravan, back to Civica, back to anywhere, but
this is the backbone of Venda.
I tugged on the reins, stopping my horse, my breath coming in gasps. Why did you bring me here? I asked. The Komazar looked at me, perturbed at the sudden stop.
It serves Venda. That's all you need to know.
He clicked the reins, moving us forward again until we were 12 lengths from the longhouse. He stopped and turned to the soldiers.
Keep her here, in plain view.
He rode down to the hamlet with a soldier following close behind and dismounted, speaking with those who had emerged from their homes. We couldn't hear what was said from where we waited, but it was clear the villagers were happy to see him. He turned and pointed at me, then talked with them again. The people peered at me, nodding, and one man was so bold as to slap the Komazar on the back, a slap that looked a little too much like the Komazar had just met with victory. He left a sack of flour and barley and returned to where we waited. "Am I to know what you told them?" I asked. He waved the soldiers to follow, and we moved on past the hamlet.
"The hill folk are a superstitious lot," he said. "I may disdain such magical thinking, but they still cling to it. A princess of the enemy, with the gift no less, they take as a sign that the gods are favoring Venda. It fills them with hope, and hope can fill their stomachs as well as bread. Sometimes it's all they have through a long, bitter winter."
I stopped my horse, refusing to go farther. "You still haven't said what you told them about me."
"I told them you ran from the enemy swine to join our ranks, called by the gods themselves."
"You lying!" He reached out and grabbed me, almost pulling me from my saddle.
"Careful, princess," he hissed, his face close to mine. "Do not forget who you are when you speak, nor who I am. I'm the Komazar, and I'll give them a morsel of whatever they need to fill their growling bellies. Do you understand?"
The horses jostled beneath us, and I feared I would fall to the ground between them. "Yes," I answered, "perfectly."
"Good, then."
He released me, and we traveled on for several miles until the next hamlet came into view. "So this is how it shall go all day?" I asked. "Am I never to meet the backbone of Venda, or will I only be pointed at with your long, bony finger?" He looked down briefly at his gloved hands, and a sliver of satisfaction warmed me.
"You're hot-tempered," he said, "and not mindful of your mouth. Could I trust you, or would you slash away at their hope?"
I looked at him, wondering why a man who seemed to feed on sowing fear was now so sensitively concerned with sowing hope in the hill folk. Was it really just the coming winter that he was trying to prepare them for, or was he bolstering them for something else? "I know what it means to hold on to hope, Komazar. Many times in crossing the Kamlanto, it was all that sustained me. I would not steal their hope, even if it comes at my expense." He eyed me with suspicion.
"You're a strange girl, Leah. Shrewd and calculating, Malik tells me, and adept at games, which I admire. But I do not admire lying."
Our gazes were locked, his black eyes trying to read every line of my face.
"Do not disappoint me."
He clicked his reins and moved on. As we got closer, the longhouse door opened and an old man limped out, aided by a crooked stick. I had noticed in Venda that there were few stooped adults with white hair. It seemed that the aged were a rare treasure. More people trickled out behind him. The man greeted the Komazar as an equal, not as one of his fearful, groveling subjects.
"What brings you?" he asked. "A few gifts to tide you through the winter."
The Komazar signaled a guard, who hefted a large, tied bundle onto his shoulder and dropped it near the longhouse door.
"News?"
the Komazar asked. The old man shook his head.
"The winds are sharp. They cut both rider and tongue, and the gods promise a hard winter."
"But spring has greater promise," the Komazar said, "and that hope can stave off the talons of winter."
They spoke in riddles I couldn't follow. The old man looked at me.
And this?
The Komazar grabbed my arm and pulled me forward so the old man could get a good look.
A princess of Morrigan, with the gift. She's run from the enemy swine to join our ranks, called by the gods themselves. Already the enemy scatters. And as you can see, he said, viewing my vest, she's been welcomed by the clan of Murasi.
The old man aimed a squinted eye at me.
That so?
The Komazar's grip on my arm tightened. I looked into the old man's eyes, hoping to convey more with a gaze than my words.
It is as your Komazar says. I am a princess, first daughter of Morrigan, and I've run from my countrymen who are your enemy.
The Komazar looked sideways at me, a slight smile creasing his eyes.
And your name, girl?
The old man asked.
I knew you would come. The voice was as clear as the old man's.
I closed my eyes, trying to chase it away, but it only came louder and stronger.
Jezalia, the one marked with power, the one marked with hope.
I opened my eyes. Everyone stared at me, silent and waiting, their eyes wide with curiosity.
Jezalia, I answered. My name is Jezalia.
His watery eyes studied me, and then he turned to the others standing behind him.
Jezalia, who has been welcomed by the clan of Murasi, he repeated.
They spoke in hushed tones among themselves. The Komazar leaned close, whispering in my ear,
Well done, princess. A convincing touch.
It was only a clever sham to him, but clearly more to these hill folk. The old man turned back to us.
Some Thanis to warm you on your way?
He offered. The Komazar forced a weak smile. Even he thought Thanis tasted like sour dirt.
We need to be on our way.
We thank you for your graciousness, I interrupted. We would love some.
The Komazar shot me a dark glare, but didn't balk in front of the old man, as I knew he wouldn't. It would never do to have a newcomer embrace the tradition of Venda more than its ruler, no matter how distasteful it was. I lifted the proffered mug to my lips. Yes, sour, moldy dirt, but not half as bad as wiggling white grubs. I drank heartily and handed my mug to the woman who served it, thanking her for her kindness. The Komazar took twice as long to down his. He berated me when I didn't offer a display of the gift at our next stop. You said word passes quickly among the hill folk. A light touch is better than a heavy-handed performance. Leave them wanting more. He laughed.
Shrewd and calculating. Malik was right.
And he is right about so few things. And so the day went, hamlet after hamlet, the Komazar gaining favor with gifts, sacks of flour and morsels of hope, with me as proof that the enemy was trembling and that the gods were smiling on Venda. Mid-afternoon, we rested in a valley while the horses drank from a brook. The wind picked up, and the sky grew dark. I held my cloak close about my shoulders, standing apart from the Komazar and soldiers, and looked out at the vista, a land dusky and barren, washed in the colors of a dark, pebbled river. The day had shown me that Venda was an unforgiving place, and only the hardiest survived here. A remnant may have been spared, but only a chosen faithful few had been led by the gods and the girl Morrigan to a land of plenty. Venda was not that land. It had taken the brunt of the devastation. As we rode, We passed forests of stone, rolling hills with only occasional hints of green, fields of burnt red rock, windswept trees twisted into haunting shapes that made them look alive, strips of farmland where small crops were coaxed from hard soil, and distant deadlands where the Komazar said nothing lived or grew. Lands as forbidding as Infernatare. And yet there was something compelling about the landscape. All I had seen were people trying to survive, faithful in their own ways, adding a bone at a time to tethers, remembering the sacrifice that put it there and the sacrifices yet to be made. People in barbarian dress, like the clothing I wore now. People who didn't speak in grunts, but in humble notes of gratitude. I knew you would come. The words I had heard still bored into me. A strong gust tore at my clothes, and my hair whipped free of the braid. I pushed the wild strands from my face and stared at the endless landscape and darkening clouds crushing the horizon. With two horses, how far could Rafe and I run? Could we disappear into the emptiness for even a few days? Because 3 days alone with him now seemed like the gift of a lifetime. I'd do anything for it. We'd been apart for too long.
So deep in thought.
I whirled around. I didn't hear you walk up.
Not wise in this wilderness to be so lost in your reflections that you forget your back. The hyenas prowl this late in the day, especially for little morsels like you.
He glanced to where I had been looking, a long horizon and endless dipping hills.
What were you thinking?
He asked. Am I not free to own anything? Not even my thoughts?
No, he answered. Not anymore.
And I knew he meant it. He studied my face as if waiting for a lie, waiting for something. I remained silent. Seconds ticked by, and I thought he might strike me. He finally shook his head.
If you need to take care of personal matters, my men and I will turn our backs for a few minutes. I know how your kind are about your privacy. Be quick about it.
I watched him walk off, wondering at how he had backed down, wondering about everything. He had saved Caden, sent food for the hungry, was tireless in knowing his kingdom, from personally retrieving governors to meeting with distant hill folk. Could I have been wrong about him? I remembered his cruel taunt, "You did well, Chievdar," when he pulled Walther's baldric from the captured booty. He knew it would bring me to my knees. But it was more than that that fed my doubts about him. It was his eyes, hungry for everything, even my own thoughts. "Be careful, sister." My brother's warning burned beneath my ribs. And yet, when we stopped at the last hamlet, and I saw him embrace the elders and leave gifts, saw the hope that he left behind, and remembered it was he who had saved Caden from the savagery of his own kind, I wondered if anything I felt in my gut really mattered.
And Morrigan raised her voice to the heavens, kissing two fingers, one for the lost, and one for those yet to come, for the winnowing was not over. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 4. Chapter 31. Caden.
After 4 days on the road, I decided the gods were against me. Maybe they always had been. No such luck that the governor would be coming my way, half-sloshed and late. The brothel in the last town hadn't had the pleasure of his visit yet, and that was a stop he never missed. he was still somewhere on the road from here to there, or he hadn't left yet at all. Damn Governor Tierney. I'd wring his neck when I caught up with him, unless someone else had already done that job for me. The weather was miserable, cold winds by day, cold rain by night. The men who traveled with me were surly. Winter was coming early. But it wasn't the icy winds that were leaving me raw. It was my last night with Leah. I had never told anyone, not even the Komazar, what my mother's name was. Catherine. It was as though I had raised her from the dead. I had seen her again, heard her voice again, as I told Leah about her. Saying her name aloud, something tore inside of me. But then I couldn't stop telling Leah more, remembering how much my mother had loved me, the only person who had ever loved me. That wasn't something I had wanted to share with Leah, but in the dark, once I had said her name, it all poured out, right down to the color of her eyes. And my father's eyes. That memory stopped me. I hadn't told her everything. Leah, like a whisper on the wind. At first, I had thought that was all it was, the wind and long hours riding alone. When Leah had first told me her name in the tavern, it had reminded me of the hush I heard riding across the savanna. Leah through the canyons in the desert. Leah, the cry of a distant wolf. Leah, wheedling into my heart before I ever laid eyes on her. And then Leah, as I stood over her in the darkness of her room, my knife in hand. It was a whisper I finally couldn't ignore, though I had managed to choke it from my life from the moment I met the Komazar. The knowing had only brought me pain. I had used it the way Leah had. I had told the lady of the manor she was going to die a slow and horrible death, though I had seen no such thing. I was 8 years old and angry that it was my own mother who was dying and not the petty one of my half-brothers, a woman who had never shown me any kindness. That was when my first beating came. It was at the hands of my father, not the beggars. They only left scars atop the ones he had already laid deep. Which one was it, Caden? His name was one I would never give up, not even to Leah. But it would be my name on his lips as he lay dying. My name would be the one he uttered as he gasped his last breath, knowing he had been betrayed by his own son. It was a thought that had warmed me for years. Our plans. That moment had always been implicit in them. We rounded the pass and had started to make our descent into the valley when we saw them coming toward us. I stopped our procession until I was certain who they were. I sighed and signaled us forward again to meet them. We must never grow lazy. But the governor of Arliston had. There would be no neck to wring. He was dead. The squad of men heading our way bore the flags of Arliston, and the man leading them had to be the new governor, a sturdy man, but not young as challengers usually were. I didn't care. He was headed in the right direction, knowing his duty, and that was all that mattered. I could return to the sanctum now. I could return home to Leah. The last stray governor had been found.
Chapter 32. Rafe.
That door, Ulrich grumbled, pointing ahead. I'll be back in 2 hours. It won't take me that long to bathe, but my duties will take me that long. Sit tight until I come back for you. He stomped off, still angry that I had won a hot bath in a game of cards last night. He claimed he'd let me win because I stank, which may have been true. As much as I wanted an actual bath, my real purpose was to see more of the layout of the sanctum, and I knew that the bath chamber was closer to the tower where Leah stayed with Caden. While I had been given some liberties in my movement, traveling alone to a different part of the sanctum wasn't among them. I memorized the path we took, asking Ulrich's innocuous questions, trying to determine which hallways were the most frequently traveled and where they led. Ulrich's, even with his short temper, proved useful. I opened the door to the bath chamber, and there, as promised, was a tub filled with water. I dipped my hand in, lukewarm at best, but more than inviting after only being able to wash up with a basin of cold water. There was soap and a towel, too. Ulrich's must have been feeling generous. I threw my clothes off and shoved my head in first, scrubbing my face and scalp, then got in and soaked. But the water was rapidly cooling, so I washed and got out before it turned cold. I dried off and was only half-dressed when I felt hands on my bare back. I spun, and there was Leah, pushing me up against the wall. "What are you doing here?" I said. "You can't." She drew my face to hers and kissed me, warm and long, her fingers raking through my wet hair. I pulled away. "You have to leave. Someone might..." But then my mouth came down on hers again, hard and hungry, sending a far different message than the one I was trying to convey. My hands slid around her waist, traveled up her back, soaking in all the lost time and days that I had wanted to hold her. "No one saw me," she said between kisses. "Yet." "I heard Ulrich's tell you he'd be gone for 2 hours, and no one will check on me for at least that." My body molded to hers. I could taste the desperation in her kisses. And then she whispered about the distant hills of Venda she had seen, endless hills we could get lost in. "For a few days, if we're lucky," I said. "That's not enough. I want a lifetime with you." She faltered for a moment, brought back to our reality, then rested her cheek on my chest. "What are we going to do, Rafe?" she asked. "It's been 12 days, and only a matter of a dozen more before riders return with news of the king's good health." "Stop counting the days, Leah," I said. "You'll drive yourself mad." "I know," she whispered, and stepped back. Her eyes grazed my bare chest. "You should get dressed before you catch cold," she said. With her so close, I was anything but cold, but I grabbed my shirt and put it on. She helped me button it, and every brush of her fingers seared my skin. "How did you get out of your room?" I asked. "There's an abandoned passageway. It doesn't lead to much, mostly busy hallways, which makes it useless most of the time. But sometimes, opportunity presents itself." She didn't seem worried about how she'd get back to her room undetected, though I was. She put her finger to my lips and told me to stop, saying we had precious little time together and she wasn't going to use it worrying about that, too. "I already told you I'm good at sneaking," she said. "I have years of experience at it." I barred the door and moved empty buckets from a cot to the floor so we could sit. We updated each other on what little we knew. She nestled in my arms, telling me about traveling through the countryside of Venda and how the people there were just like any others, people trying to survive. She said they were kind and curious and nothing like the council. I told her what I had learned about the pathways from Ulrich's, but I held back on some things I had been doing, particularly the weapons I had managed to hide. I had seen the fire in her eyes when she talked about sneaking one from the barrows in the sanctum. She had witnessed her brother's brutal death, and I couldn't blame her for wanting revenge. But I didn't want her retrieving a knife or sword before the timing was right. She pushed on my shoulders to make me lie back, and I pulled her with me, my caution crumbling. I wanted her more than life itself. She looked down at me and traced her finger along my jaw. "Prince Rafferty," she said curiously, as if still trying to grasp who I really was. "Jackson is what they call me back in Dalbrek. But I'll always call you Rafe. Are you disappointed that I'm not a farmer?" She smiled. "You may learn to grow melons yet. Or maybe we'll grow other things," I said, pulling her close. And we kissed again and again. "Leah," I finally whispered, trying to bring us both back to our senses. "We have to be careful." She pressed her forehead to mine, silent, then settled back against my shoulder. And we talked, almost as we had on our last night together in Taravin. But this time, I told her the truth. My parents weren't dead. I told her what they were like, and a little bit about Dalbrek. "Were they angry when I ran from the wedding?" "My father was furious. My mother was heartbroken, both for me and herself. She was eager to have a daughter." She shook her head. "Rafe, I'm so—" "Shh, don't say it. You don't owe anyone an apology." And then I told her the rest, that it was never proposed to me as a real marriage, and that my father had even suggested I take a mistress after the wedding if the bride didn't suit my tastes. "A mistress? Well, isn't that romantic?" She leaned up on one arm to look at me. "What about you, Rafe?" she said more softly. "What did you think when I didn't show up?" I thought back to that morning, waiting in the cloister of the abbey along with the entire Dalbrek cabinet, pulling at my coat. We'd had to ride all night, delayed because of the weather, and I just wanted to get it over with. "When the news came that you had left, I was surprised," I said. "That was my first reaction. I couldn't quite figure out how it could happen. Two kingdoms cabinets had worked out every detail. In my mind, it may as well have already been chiseled in stone. I couldn't understand how one girl could undo the plans of the most powerful men on the continent. Then, when I finally got past my shock, I was curious about you."
"You weren't angry?"
I grinned. "Yes, I was," I conceded. "I wouldn't admit it at the time, but I was furious too." She rolled her eyes. "Ha! As if I didn't know. I suppose it was apparent when I got to Taravin. The minute you walked into that tavern, I knew you were trouble, Prince Rafferty." I wove my fingers through her hair and pulled her closer. "As I did you, Princess Arabella." Her lips pressed to mine, and I wondered if there would ever be a day we didn't have to cut our time together short. But I was getting worried about Oryx. He'd been gone almost an hour, I guessed, and I didn't want to take a chance in case he returned early. When I pushed her away, she promised to leave in 5 more minutes. 5 minutes is hardly enough time to drink an ale, but we filled it with memories from our time in Taravin. I finally told her she had to go. I looked out the door first to make sure the hall was clear. She touched my cheek before she left and said, "Someday we'll go back to Taravin, won't we, Rafe?" "We will," I whispered, because that was what she needed to hear. But as the door shut behind her, I knew if we ever got out of here, I would never take her back to anywhere in Morrigan, including Taravin.
Chapter 33.
I tried to stop counting the days as Rafe had told me to, but each day that the Komazar took me out to a different quarter, I knew we had one less. Our outings were brief, just long enough to show me off to this elder or that quarter lord and those who gathered around, planting his version of hope among the superstitious. For a man who had little patience for lying, he sowed the myth of my arrival freely, like seed thrown by handfuls in the wind. The gods were blessing Venda. Strangely, an equilibrium settled in between us. It was like dancing with a hostile stranger. With each of our steps, he got what he wanted, the added devotion of the clans and hillfolk, and I got something I wanted too, though I couldn't quite put a name to it. It was a strange pull in unexpected ways and times. The glint of the sun, a shadow, the cook chasing a loose chicken down the hallway, the smoke in the air, a sweetened cup of Thanis, the brisk chill of morning, a toothless smile, the resonance of Paviyama chanted back to me, the dark stripes of sky as I chanted eventide remembrances. They were all disconnected moments that added up to nothing, and yet they caught hold of me like fingers lacing into mine and drawing me forward. The advantage of having Caden gone was that I was left to my own devices at night. In his rush to make arrangements before he left, Caden had only told Aster to come and escort me to the bath chamber if I requested it and help me with personal needs, but he hadn't defined what those needs might be. I assured her my nighttime request was one of those needs. It turned out she was happy to conspire with me. The sanctum was far warmer than the hovel she shared with her papa and cousins. I had asked her if she knew of a way to get to the catacombs without passing through the main hallway. Her eyes grew wide.
You want to go to the ghoul caves?
Apparently Eben and Finch weren't the only ones who called it that. Grizz was right. The little urchin knew every mouse trail in the sanctum, and there were many. In one of them, I had to get down on my hands and knees to crawl through. As we walked through another, I heard a distant roar.
What's that? I whispered.
We don't want to go that way, she said. That tunnel leads to the bottom of the cliffs. Nothing there but the river, lots of wet rock, and bridge gears.
She led me down an opposite path, but I made note of the way. A path that led to the bridge, even though it was impossible to raise, was something I wanted to explore. We finally emerged into a wider cave-like tunnel, and the familiar sweet smell of oil and dusty air welcomed us. I thought at this hour it would be empty, but we heard footsteps. We hid in the shadows, and when the dark-robed men shuffled past, we followed a safe distance behind. I understood now why it was called Ghoul Caves. The walls weren't just made of broken ruins. Human bones and skulls lined the path, 1,000 ancients holding up the sanctum, poised to whisper their secrets, ones Aster didn't want to hear. When she saw them and gasped, I clapped my hand over her mouth and nodded reassurance. They can't hurt you, I said, though I wasn't so sure myself. Their empty socket stairs followed our steps. The narrow path led in a steep downward slope to an enormous room, one that bore the art and architecture of another time, and I guessed that it might date all the way back to the ancients. Deep in the ground, and perhaps sealed away for centuries, it was in remarkably good repair, and so were its contents. It wasn't just any room, but a room full of books that would make the royal scholar pale. It dwarfed all his libraries put together. At the far end, I saw the robed men sorting books into stacks and occasionally tossing one into a mountain of discards. Similar mountains were scattered throughout the room. Partially hidden from view was a wide, curved opening to another room beyond this one. Light poured out of it, bright and golden. I could see at least one figure inside, hunched over a table, writing on ledgers. This was an extensive, organized effort. Passing shadows flickered across the floor. There were others in that room, too. Those who sorted the books in the outside room occasionally took one into them. I desperately wanted to see what they were doing and what the books were that they studied.
"You want one?"
Aster whispered. "No," I said. "They might see us."
"Not me,"
she answered, showing off how low she was able to crouch. "And it ain't really stealing, because they burn those piles in the kitchen ovens." They burned them? I thought about the two books I had stolen from the scholar, both of their leather covers scorched with fire. Before I could stop her, Aster darted out, quiet as a shadow, and snatched a small book from the discards. When she ran back, her little chest heaved with excitement, and she proudly handed me her prize. It was bound differently from any books I had ever seen, razor straight and tight, and I didn't recognize the language. If it was some form of Vendan, it was even older than the Song of Venda I had translated. That's when I knew what they were doing. They were translating ancient languages, which explained why the services of skilled scholars were needed. I knew of three other kingdoms besides Morrigan that had a stable of scholars with any measurable skills. Gastineau, my mother's homeland, Turquoy Tra, which was home to mystic monks, and Dalbrek. Since they had discarded this book, I knew it wasn't important to them. But at least I knew now what their purpose here was. Deciphering a saved tomb of books, the lost books of the ancients. For a society where few of its people even read, this was an odd scholarly activity. My curiosity burned, but I fought the urge to confront and question them because it would reveal my nighttime wanderings and put Aster at risk as well. I tucked the book under my arm and nudged her toward the pathway of skulls, and we hurried back to my room.